How's the spreadsheet this out? HHS. You see it?
Good afternoon. The Committee of Higher Education and Workforce Development Division will now come to order. Today's date is Tuesday, March 25th. We do have two bills to be heard this morning, or this afternoon, rather. Senator Dahl, Senate File 2304. And we do have a quorum. Welcome, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I have Senate File 2304, and I know you I think Senator Bonhoff said to be brief today, and we will, as bill's been through at least one committee and that I know of. But this is a pretty exciting bill and a great project for the University of Minnesota for so many different reasons. Every time I tell people about this bill, they want to be an author or they want to be a co-author or they want to get on board. And I find myself talking about it even for people outside this Capitol building because it has such long-term implications for agriculture, for the environment, for water, for conservation efforts, for jobs, for rural communities. I mean, I can go on and on and on, but I'll let the testifiers talk to you about this vision that we have. We've been a state that's relied on corn and soybeans and some animals for so long, which thanks to you on those two crops. But we have so many other potential crops that we can to work into the system that it's really good for the environment and for ag. And so I'm going to turn it over now to Professor Don Wise, who's Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics at the University of Minnesota. And I have a couple others here that also may want to say a few words as well.
Welcome, Dr. Wise, and would you please state your name and position for the record?
Yes, I'm Don Wise. I'm a professor in the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics at the University of Minnesota, and certainly appreciate the opportunity to talk about this initiative. We're calling it the Forever Green Initiative because it's designed to put living plant materials on the landscape throughout the entire year, not just the growing season that we would classically think of, but they would be active living plants throughout the entire 365 days of the year. At one time, you know, you can go back possibly to the 40s, and some of us can remember those days a little bit. The agricultural landscape was very diverse. And if you look at this handout that I provided you, if you look at the bottom, this is the dramatic change that has occurred since the 40s into the 70s. And now, as we most all know, as we drive across the Midwest, it is a two-crop, three-crop system throughout the entire Midwest. It isn't the fact that it is, in fact, two crops. They are annuals. We basically have lost all of our perennial component. Why did that change? Livestock were moved off of individual farms to feedlots, right? In that process, we lost most of our pasture land, alfalfa. We moved from alfalfa to a new protein source, the soybean. That, again, was developed at the University of Minnesota and has played a primary role. But the point is, this is where we're at. We have an annual cropping system, and we all know some of the impacts. And what I'd like to do is just move you to page 3 in that same handout. Pick Iowa and Minnesota in those two pictures. Look at the date. This is a satellite shot looking at the chlorophyll content on the landscape. It should be green. Look how long it's brown. It doesn't give a complete green color until the end of June, right? And that means there's no active or limited amount of active roots in that soil to hold what? Soil and nitrate nitrogen, right? Now watch it turn green in July and in August, and it's gone again by the middle of September. Count the months, 2.5 months. Do we have extensive living color cover in the context of our corn and soybean rotation landscape? What can go wrong? Right? Nitrate nitrogen moves through that system into tile lines, into groundwater, and out into our surface waters. And I was just looking at the recent report that was put out by Pollution Control, looking at the tons of nitrogen that flows out the Red River or down the Mississippi. If you just took the value of that nitrogen, we could build a Vikings facility every decade. $1.3 billion. Just forget about the pollution, but the value of that nitrogen that we move through that system, basically because we do not have roots there to hold that nitrogen. It becomes a pollutant and loss in dollars to our economy. All right. This isn't new information. We've known this for many, many years. A lot of you have heard of Giles Randall at Waseca. He showed this differential, 20 years ago. Looking at the current corn and soybean rotation, each acre you drop out between 20 and 40 pounds of nitrate nitrogen into tile lines. If you go to a perennial system, even I caught onto this, it's two. Right, that's the differential. Well, why aren't farmers out there putting these new plant materials on the landscape? We haven't developed at the University of Minnesota new plant materials for that landscape in well over 50 years. Basically, the focus has been on those annual crops, and we've done very, very well, right? Highly productive. From a production perspective, they do extremely, extremely well. But there's a new focus. How do we provide those ecosystem services? How do we reduce erosion? How do we keep that nitrate nitrogen in place and even be more profitable than we currently are? From my department's perspective, from my college's perspective, we believe that is the grand challenge. How do you go about, in the same way, my department, my college, brought you corn, soybeans, wheat, and barley? With a public investment, how do we now go about bringing on the next generation of plant materials? Well, what are they? Well, we have a list of about 16 in your other document. And it's not just a list. Our team, our graduate students, two of them sitting over here, have been actively engaged in filling a new product delivery pipeline. What's our focus? How do you fill that brown? Winter annuals and perennials. So four of our primary initiatives as of right now are a new winter annual oilseed crop, pennycress, hazelnuts, intermediate wheatgrass, a perennial grain that General Mills and other groups are very interested in, because they're interested in developing not only a healthy food, but also the opportunity to sell a product that produces a healthy landscape. So for us, that is the grand challenge. How do we go about developing that plant material? Well, why hasn't it happened before? Well, there's been some major changes. Remember how a big deal it was when they released the human genome? And the billions of dollars that went in the production of that area of science? Kevin Doran over here, working on pennycress, sequenced the genome for pennycress, a plant, in 9 months for $75,000. The things that we were just dreaming about in terms of domestication of new crops that were just a pipe dream, something that could happen maybe 100 years from now, we're talking 5 to 10. It's a whole new shift in our ability to move new plant material not only out into the marketplace, into the landscape, but also to produce real viable products. And that's the other component of this work. As we develop these plant materials, I don't want to just develop plant materials to put on the landscape. Each one of these ideas that we're presenting to you have an economic pull. All right? Our partners are General Mills, Patagonia, Estee Lauder, Aveda, a wide range of organizations from food companies to cosmetics that are interested in components that can be pulled out of these new plant materials that produce those ecosystem services but also very active in developing opportunities for the workforce for the state of Minnesota into the future, to create opportunities for the students that we have here today. There's 16 of them are part of this program, and they would not be at the University of Minnesota, would not have the opportunity to become part of the workforce if it wasn't for these new ideas. It brings in a wide range of very bright, interested, engaged students that are working on products that are going to change the landscape and also change the economic carrying capacity of the state of Minnesota. So in just a short presentation, I think that gives you a general idea of what we're trying to do. And in the more details are in these handouts if you'd like to take time. And we would love to have you take the time to look at these ideas.
Thank you, Dr. Wise. Comments, questions from committee members?
And Mr. Chair, I think as Dr. Wise has mentioned that the movement is towards natural products and so forth, and I guess some of those crops that he's talking about have natural preservatives in them, that those are the things that Estee Lauder and Aveda, they are looking for, which I think they have to import from across the ocean, I think, in many instances. So we're trying to build this crop here in this country where we can take advantage of that and sell to those companies that are really seeking those kinds of opportunities. So, am I right?
Yes, Chairman. Yeah, that's exactly right. Maybe I didn't give enough detail there. That when you look at Estee Lauder, the Aveda Corporation, a lot of you know the Aveda Corporation, they're very interested in producing commercial products that have a natural base. That is taking off beyond the Aveda Corporation. They're looking for preservatives that come from natural components that can be incorporated into their products. And General Mills is doing exactly the same thing. They want to replace the petroleum-based preservatives in their food products with natural bases, which obviously opens up the possibility for figuring out how to put more native plants out on the landscape, because that's the source of this these compounds. It's from native plants, native to North America. It's another reason for getting these mixers out there that can support natural predators, the bees, those types of beneficial insects, and also plays a role in suppression of invasive species that would be moving into a region.
Dr. Wise, I do have a question. Is it assumed that we will be taking some crops out of rotation through this process? And if we do, that what is the economic implications for let's say ethanol and other existing economic incentives that we have?
Let me give you two examples, if I might. The pennycress. The pennycress is designed to fill the brown period. It would be seeded into corn. It would overwinter in the rosette stage. It would then develop in the spring. It will be developing in the next couple of weeks. Believe it or not, it's going to happen, I predict. It would start its development very early. It will produce a mature crop by the end of May. The idea is to harvest 30 bushels of oilseed crop and then no-till in soybeans. It does not displace soybeans or corn from that landscape. Intermediate wheatgrass would be another crop that would potentially displace some of our current crops, but it's not going to displace them unless it's economically viable, right? So I learned all of this when I was brought to Minnesota 40 years ago by the grass seed producers in northern Minnesota that wanted to figure out how to reduce their risk in their agricultural system. I'm the guy that has developed and released the Pony ryegrass lines that built that industry in northern Minnesota. Why is it there? It competes in the marketplace. Our lines now produce 115 pounds of seed. The farmers today, marketing to the world, receive $1 a pound. That's $1,500 an acre. That's competitive with any. That's the model that I envision for all of this work. Right? And certainly not displacing corn and soybeans. We're talking about places where these crops would fit, and they would fit better, even be more profitable, and would be less costly to society than limiting the idea that we can only plant 2 to 3 crops. It gives the farmers want more options.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments?
A question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Dr. Weiss?
Yes.
Hello, and Senator Dahl, thanks for bringing this forward. This seems to be something worthwhile. Is there not the ability to fund it from within existing funds at the university?
Senator, this work at the level that I can present it to you today would not be here without the support of the University of Minnesota. A lot of you realize that we've produced, as I described, the cereal grains for the state of Minnesota. And in recent years, some royalties have come back from those dollars. Our experiment station have made some of those dollars available to support this work over a 3-year period of time. So it's dollars like that, along with the specialty crop initiative. Out of the federal dollars, some of those dollars have been used to support the development of the hazelnut industry. But in most cases, we don't have a commodity to go to. We're pre-commodity, right, in terms of having those dollars there to come back from the grains that are out on the landscape. But the University of Minnesota has been supportive of this work, has allowed us to get to the point that we're at, but we're now moving into a new phase. You know, it's a lot of us do is we go along in these programs and you have to decide whether it's a go, no go. I would argue that a lot of folks now believe this is a go. How do we now boost the activity to deliver those products that we really believe with the new technology that we can really put in place at this stage that would make this opportunity available to the private sector in the very near future?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we have another testifier here. Steve Morris from the Minnesota Environmental Partnership would like to say a word or two.
Senator Peterson, any question?
I can wait till the end of the testimony as well and ask my question.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Morris. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. And we are the state's largest coalition of environmental conservation organizations with combined membership of something over 400,000 Minnesotans. And you might think it's a little odd that we are here supporting this legislation, but we're doing it for a number of different reasons. First of all, because what these systems represent is really moving to the next level of agricultural operation where you have multi-benefit systems that will not only give us prosperity and profitability, which, as Dr. Weiss said, is critically important to make it viable, but will also, by design, give us healthier soils, cleaner water, and better habitat. When we designed our current systems generations ago, we were really kind of singular in our focus. But we've gotten smarter than that, as we have in many different areas, and now we can look at systems that give us these multiple benefits. Dr. Weiss mentioned the PCA's nitrogen report from earlier this year. And what it basically showed is, as we're looking at this and trying to figure out how to clean up our waterways across the state, in the agricultural landscapes, you can do all the good, standard, and new and promising best management practices. Do everything right in your production while you're growing corn and beans, and you're going to fall far short of restoring our water quality. What the PCA is acknowledging now is that we have to put more green cover back on the landscape during these brown periods that we're talking about. So this is an effort that is agricultural friendly, to say what are the viable cropping systems that we can put on the ground in those shoulder seasons that will actually, we hope, increase profitability while also providing us those other benefits. And that's really what it's all about. So we're here because of the healthy soil, healthy water, and the habitat that this brings us. And lastly, I want to say, well, a couple of things. It's really a Minnesota tradition. And Dr. Weiss talked about the grass seed. As many of you know, some of you who know my history, I was initially an apple grower, second-generation apple grower. And our apples, like our grapes, like our grasses, were all industries that were developed by the University of Minnesota, who put an effort into developing varieties that fit here in our state and can be grown here profitably. Honeycrisp is a case in point. Honeycrisp, the royalties from that variety now fund the entire horticultural research programs at the University of Minnesota. The problem is that the traditional commodities have a marketing order. There's money that goes into a research and marketing pot on all sales that kind of automatically fund that system. On these new kind of cutting edge, next generation systems, there is no mechanism by which to fund those. So what we need is some seed money, relatively modest amount, $1.4 million, to provide some core faculty along with some research and graduate assistance to move this forward on a long-term commitment to get us to the next generation of a prosperous ag system. And I'll be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Questions? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Senator Claussen. Mr. Chair, excuse me. Getting to the question that Senator Bonoff asked, I take it by the answer that was given that there really is nothing precluding the University of Minnesota from continuing to fund the program as it has in the past. The point that I made, I think, in the last committee hearing, and really with any special earmarked appropriation like this for the university, is that you could literally list thousands of wonderful things that the University of Minnesota does, and every one of them could bring on a panel of experts as qualified as yourself that could advocate for their own stream of funding. And so the question, you know, again, for the committee is whether we're going to go about doing that and funding every type of research project, or whether we're going to just appropriate money and allow the university to, and the expertise that they have, to designate those appropriations in the way that they see best fits the mission and the various merits of the program. So not so much a question, but more of a statement. I think this bill is in line with that same issue. I think it's worthwhile to have the hearing, Madam Chair. You know, it is to cover sort of, to shed some light on the great things that the university is doing. That's all my comments for now, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. Yes,
and
Senator.
I'm sorry, members, Mr. Chair, but might,
yes,
just,
Senator Bonoff.
Because I wasn't there at the beginning, it is our intent to lay this over for possible inclusion, as it really is the philosophy of the committee, as Senator. So if other members were concerned about that same thing, that is the belief of the committee, with few exceptions.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Morris wanted to just comment on Senator Peterson's query.
And if I could, and thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, and I understand that sensitivity. What we are trying to do is bring some additional resources actually from the environmental side. We hope that there'll be money flowing from other resource centers to the university to help make this happen, because the university is putting in a tremendous amount of support. We've worked with them on this legislation. They're providing the infrastructure. And what we're trying to do is bring some additional money, like in the commodity groups, it might come from some of the marketing orders to actually fund some of the direct costs. But we're trying to get that money from Clean Water Fund, the environmental budget, and other areas to bring into the equation.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up then, because this, a similar answer was at least implied last time, and for testimony for the committee, for the staff, one of the questions that I would be interested in knowing every time we hear one of these bills is whether or not these programs are leveraging additional investments that from either the private sector or other public entities or nonprofits. That's one of the decisions that I think could make each one of these proposals distinct, you know, amongst the group, rather than, of course, you know, like I said, there could be 1,000 different programs that all have some merit, but knowing exactly what that is going forward and having people prepared to testify to that, I think makes their case stronger.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I didn't want to leave the impression that there is agreement on that statement from Senator Peterson. Actually, I completely disagree with that. I think that we're not investing enough in this research and these industries and connecting the actual research with the potential that exists in agriculture. And we have neglected that at the University of Minnesota significantly to the really disservice of the economy of the state. And I have said this here before. I had a conversation with Senator Sharon about other issues related to taxes and related to minimum wage and other things, that we continuously in this body and, you know, in general politically talk about the importance of supporting businesses in terms of taxing and not investing in the industries that are important to the state. To me, these industries are really, they need to be the core focus for us to develop prosperity in rural Minnesota. And we have that opportunity because the university is there helping us, just like you talk about the apples. Now we're talking about grasses. And I think the potential is huge. And that's where I believe that the money needs to go. But we, in my view, we're not having that conversation in a meaningful way. And I hope, Senator Dahl, that you continue to push for this. And I am not a rural senator, and I don't know, truthfully, anything about agriculture. I'm not part of, but I feel very strongly that it is a potential for our state that we are not investing enough and that we could see tremendous prosperity in terms of business and economic development, and we're not doing enough. So I really want to put that out there as an urban member who's very interested in this issue and would like to do whatever it takes to partner with rural members to get more investments in these areas and really connect with economic conversations about how to develop these businesses for the state of Minnesota, because they could be incredibly profitable and we need to invest.
Thank you, Senator Ray. Senator Pratt, and then I know Senator Saxhog is waiting, so if we could wrap up, that'd be great. Senators?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I want to support the comments Senator Peterson made in that when we talked to the university last year about their budget, and we looked at the three, you know, the three missions or three legs of the stool, so to speak, we were told that the Board of Regents, see Mr. Devine back there, made sure that the needs were met, and we invested $80 million into the University of Minnesota last year, and we're allowing the Regents to make those investments, and this is one that I think kind of falls under that purview. As well as we heard that it wasn't state money necessarily supporting research. It was predominantly coming from increased grants and investments from the private sector to make sure, because they're the ones that are going to reap the benefits from this, and they would want to be on the ground floor of these types of programs. So I agree with Senator Peterson. I think we need to know the whole program and make sure that, the Regents have the ability to make some of these decisions on resources and not have the state always be the de facto backup when decisions are made that maybe don't support a specific initiative.
So I think, members, the intention here is to just lay the bill on the table. We want to make sure to give Senator Dahl the time that this important topic deserves, and we very much appreciate those who came before us to testify. Ms. Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, and I appreciate the time today, and thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, for your comments. By the way, I bought Honeycrisp apples, $4.50 a pound last night. Brought them to the rural caucus. I'd pay more because they're that good. I would also like to say that Land Stewardship Project is a strong supporter. Bobby King here. I just wanted to mention they're here, and Farmers Union is also a big supporter of this particular initiative. So I, forever green, I hope that you keep that in the forefront of your you're going to hear more about it one way or another. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
Senator Saxhog. Senator Saxhog is currently got his own committee going, so I was sensitive to taking the chair away from his committee. So thanks for your patience, Senator Saxhog.
Well, thank you for your patience, Senator Boniff. And today I'm presenting Senate File 2102. This bill will eventually appropriate money to the University of Minnesota to develop new techniques to control terrestrial invasive species. We've heard a lot about, of aquatic invasive species, but this is about problems that with invasive species on the land, and the ones that you may have heard of are emerald ash borer, which is attacked many of our ash trees in the metropolitan area, but the largest stands of ash in the United States are in northern Minnesota, and they're about to be attacked. Also, the gypsy moth. We may have heard about quarantines that are taking place in Cook and Lake County. So those are just two examples, which are a growing problem in this case, particularly for Minnesota's forest industry. With me today are Susan Galatowicz, Department Head of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology at the University of Minnesota, and William Hutchinson, Professor and Head of Department of Entomology at the University of Minnesota. And they're going to help explain the bill and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Ms. Galatowicz.
Madam Chair, may I have a page past these handouts?
He's coming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Susan Galatowicz, Department Head within College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Science at the University of Minnesota, here on behalf of Interim Dean Brian Burr, who had to be in D.C. today for the Norman Borlaug ceremony. Thank you for inviting me today to provide input on the proposed Senate bill, Terrestrial Invasive Species Research Center. The University of Minnesota, specifically the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences, was asked by the author of the House version of this bill to provide research capacity to accelerate efforts on invasive species research. Invasive species, terrestrial invasive species in particular, have about $344 billion of adverse economic impacts in the U.S. annually. In Minnesota, it's conservatively estimated to be about a $3 billion economic loss to the state. The kinds of losses that are incurred are in agricultural and horticultural crops due to insect pests, forest products also due to insect pests, and in our natural ecosystems like prairies and wetlands that are a lot tougher to restore and maintain because of a variety of perennial weeds there. Over the past 20 years, innovation by university researchers has been key for finding solutions to some of our most problematic species, including species such as purple loosestrife in wetlands and soybean aphids in agricultural areas. This research center will serve a lead role in research on terrestrial invasive species, accelerating efforts to prevent establishment, early detection, develop new control methods, and minimizing target impacts of control. The mission of the center will be to offer science-based solutions to our most serious terrestrial invasive species threats. The College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences has the intellectual and physical capacity to effectively address these colleges. Address these challenges. Included in the college includes eight departments, including entomology, plant pathology, forest resources, horticultural science, applied econ, my own department, Fisheries and Wildlife Conservation Biology, agronomy, and plant genetics, and biosystems, and bioproducts engineering. We had unanimous support of the department heads when we met to confer over this request to our college. And so we're happy to report we have the full support of those units. In addition, the college administers eight research and outreach centers, which provide a statewide capacity to implement the solutions we come up with and to develop things that are regionally relevant. The structure and staffing that we would propose really follows the model of the successful Water Resource Center at the university, and that is a multidisciplinary center led by a faculty research director that reports directly to the college. That will allow us sort of the greatest opportunity to leverage resources and also approach these problems, you know, in a fully multidisciplinary way. Research on these species can be expensive. They're not invasive for no reason, right? They're tough. And so we expect that over a 10-year period, if we were to attempt to work on 15 to 20 species, we would need to involve and train about 18 postdocs and graduate students and those folks to basically have at the university in that role costs between $40,000 and $50,000 every year. In addition to that, there's costs associated with the expenses of doing the research itself. And so we're anticipating that over a 10-year period, that conservatively that would cost, for example, about $9 million. That's just an example to let you know sort of why it doesn't easily fit within the existing budgets of the university. So the point here is to really accelerate research beyond the capacity that we currently have. We have the infrastructure. We have the current faculty expertise. It's a matter of the rate at which we can tackle these problems, and clearly the threats are increasing, especially in light of environmental change. And so our college is ready to partner with our existing multidisciplinary capacity with full departmental support, with an emphasis on graduate student training. Probably whatever funding we receive, we would anticipate approximately at least two-thirds of it going into graduate student and professional training, and that's something that has a positive effect on the state agencies and federal agencies and other partners in the state. We have, it'll provide regional support through the research and outreach centers, and we have a strong track record of collaborating with state agencies, NGOs, LCCMR, tribal leaders, and others, and we would need to do that to accomplish these goals.
Thank you.
My name is Bill Hutchison, a professor and department head of entomology at the University of Minnesota, St. Paul campus, and I'm pleased to be here today to also just add a few words. I know we're short on time. Just to help place this in context, I guess historically, I just wanted to add a few key examples of where both insects and diseases, fungi, attacking our trees have been issues in Minnesota over the years. Back in the day, we had Dutch elm disease, which is a major fungal pathogen, but it's moved through the trees and vectored by, or was vectored by, the elm bark beetle. So this was a huge problem, and I actually just had a tree. I just found out I have two elm trees in my backyard that are dying because of Dutch elm disease, so it's still out there. The other one is oak wilt, which is also vectored by picnic or sap beetles. So my point here is that this is highly interdisciplinary in terms of the nature of the problems and the nature of the solutions, and we do have a great track record, I think, in our college of working together across disciplines to solve a lot of these issues. The most recent pest, the spotted wing Drosophila, that I was forced to work on immediately in August of 2012 when we first detected it in the state, it attacks raspberries, blueberries, blackberries, wine grapes, most of our high-value crops that we're trying to encourage as alternatives in our state. And the true test for spotted wing Drosophila, by the way, it lays 3 to 4 small white maggots per berry. So when you buy these at your farmer's market, the quick test at home is put them on the countertop. If the berries move, it's a positive ID. Or just leave them there for a couple of hours, and if you do have maggots, those maggots will be crawling out of the berries. They are high in protein, but we're not here to talk about the benefits of insects today. About 50% protein, but not desired by most customers. So that is an industry that's been hit really hard by our most recent invasive. I've had the opportunity to work with many invasives over the past 25 years, from soybean aphid to actually bringing in biological control agents to control the soybean aphid. And it's taken about 6 to 8 years of work, much of that funded by the soybean growers, actually, to make this happen. But we do have a very effective parasitic wasp now that's working well on the soybean aphid. But I just raise that point as something that does take time. This type of research takes time to respond to plan for invasives. They will continue to come, whether we like invasives or not. With international trade the way it is, including the Midwest, through Lake Michigan, many of these species have come through our ports via Chicago and then on into Wisconsin and Minnesota. So it is a very complex problem. It requires, a concerted effort to be much more organized as a college to deal with this, and we appreciate the Senate and the House who have brought this bill forward. So thank you.
Thank you. And as Senator Sachs-Hogg and I have discussed, really much of this is in the purview of Senator Tomasoni's committee. And so because it's the University of Minnesota, it was important that we hear it. But it's our intention, again, to just lay this on the table so that Senator Cohen can re-refer it to the other finance committee.
Right. Madam Chair, if we recommend that this be referred back to the finance committee, that'd be terrific.
Exactly. So, and Senator Sachs-Hogg, we can certainly do it that way. If we lay it on the table, they can take it. But but if let's go ahead and make the motion to refer it to back to the full finance. My committee administrators, that's fine. So we'll do that, Senator Sachs-Hogg.
All right.
All right, so Senator Sharon, would you move that Senate file 2102 be recommended to be referred to full finance?
Very good.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it before us. And I think all of our community are dealing with this thing, and we picture our Asian lady beetle, and exactly. What's the little bug that's now infesting our flowers?
Japanese beetles. Possibly.
Thank you.
They love roses and linden trees.
Yes.
So that's another great example.
Thank you.
Geraniums.
So, members, now what we're going to do is we are actually going to not have a bill before us, but rather to put together and put forward the articles that we hope to be our supplemental finance bill that we would move then to full finance. And so there's a few things that still have to be worked through as a committee before we look at it in totality, things that we've heard before and said we'd come back to and finish it. So, for example, Senator Claussen's bill, Senate File 403, the student loan financing bill, members had concerns around making sure we put together more structure before turning that over. And so Senator Claussen, I believe, is prepared to discuss his proposed language with us now.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Based upon comments that we had last week in presenting the bill, we do have a delete all A3 amendment, and I think you have an example of that, all of you. Just a quick review of that. Again, Senate File 403 is not an allocation, but rather the bill serves as an outline for the Office of Higher Education to further develop a student loan refinancing program. Further study on market conditions, interest rates, underwriting, and implementation procedures must be addressed. What you have in front of you, though, we did try to develop some specific things to address concerns. You'll note that the loan shall be made with funds from the Office of Higher Education Loan Capital Fund. The maximum amount of outstanding loans refinanced may not exceed $100 million, and the maximum loan to an individual may not exceed $70,000. That's the same limit for a self-loan borrower in a graduate school. The projected date to issue refinancing loans is slated for June 2015. And prior to that happening, the Office of Higher Education will report back to the committee by February 1st, 2015, with plans, proposed terms, and conditions for operating a student loan refinancing program, along with any recommended legislation as needed. So with those changes, we would seek approval.
Do members have questions? And I see Ms. Grimes here, if you want to... So the idea is ask questions, make changes, and then this language has actually already been incorporated into the article, so we won't move it per se, but just to give members. I think what Senator Claussen's done is he's put in there those limits that comply with what how we currently do SELF. And in addition, he's asking the Office of Higher Ed to get back to us with their proposals before they would ever even be doing it. So it would give the Office of Higher Ed more time to make sure that their parameters are set before this practice even begins. Ms. Grimes, do you want to say anything about it?
Madam Chair, just that we appreciate Senator Claussen's willingness to work with us on the bill. We are very excited about the prospect.
So there isn't a fiscal note at this time.
Madam Chair, if correct, I could Madam just Chair. Mention, this the loans would be funded from the self-loan fund, which is not general fund money. It's money mostly that came from revenue bonds, some taxable and some tax-exempt.
Thank you. Okay. Seeing no questions, I think you either don't have those who had the concerns in the room, which is I'm looking, that's actually the case. But we do have a banker in the room, so do you have any questions, Senator Pratt?
I move.
Donna, this, I'll follow up Senator Claussen later.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay. So then I would ask Mr. Fuller to take us through the article, and then I will reserve the right while Mr. Fuller does that to editorialize as we go through.
Madam Chair, are you referring to the 039-1 document?
Yes.
And you just want me to go through Article 2? Or Article 1 as well? There's a series of blank appropriations. This is a supplemental budget.
No, I would ask you to go through Article 2.
All right. Members, we received instructions from the Finance Committee as to how to go about the business, and we're going to submit a report to the Finance Committee. It will not be a bill, and it will be assembled into a larger supplemental budget bill. So this language would be attached to that. Section 1 on page 2, line 26, is a proposal from the Office of Higher Education, for which there's a related section here. I think if you recall last year we discussed distance education and how sometimes there was a problem because schools wouldn't come and register to offer classes because it was expensive, so it would deny people opportunities. So this is in response to that, and it sets up a framework where the office can decide whether to enter into reciprocity agreements for the purpose of distance education. You'll see later on there's a complementary provision that will exempt schools that are operating under these agreements from the registration fees. For instance, I think the University of Maryland, one person in Minnesota wanted to take a class from there, but they didn't want to come and register because it was too costly. It just didn't make sense for the University of Maryland. So I think that's the sort of problem this is intended to address.
And Mr. Fuller, I think I might actually just stop right there for a moment and let we have some people here from MAC. So we've got Jennifer Parks, who's the director of MSARA, here to just share a little bit about what's going on nationally with regard to this approach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Fuller.
No, Mr. Fuller, he's our lawyer.
Oh. Okay. Sorry. You're right. It doesn't say that on your
counsel. Esteemed yes. Senate counsel.
Thank you. Thank you for all hearing me today. I do have a number of supporters here from the Minnesota, all sectors of Minnesota's higher education community, if you do have some additional questions. But what we're talking about is giving the Office of Higher Education the ability to become the portal agency for and to decide if it wants to join into an interstate, represent Minnesota as it would decide to join what's called the State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement, or SARA, across the nation. It's administered by the four regional compacts, and actually it would be joining MSARA, the Midwestern region of this particular endeavor. I'm the director of that program. And the four regional compacts have come together to solve a problem that is plaguing higher education across the nation. Higher education is changing. It's changing very rapidly, as are so many things in our society, because of the advent of new technologies that allow us to share information and education with anyone and almost at any time, except in the case if you're an institution in one state trying to offer education to someone in another state via a distance modality. So, for example, I used to do state authorization work as a compliance officer at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse, and it was my job to make sure that our online registrations could serve students in any number of states, Maryland being one of the more problematic ones. We did have students in Maryland who wanted to attend some of our programs. We would have loved to have had their money in tuition dollars, and we would have loved to have them fill seats in some of our smaller programs to keep them open. The problem is that to get registered in Maryland to offer courses, you have to jump through a tremendous number of hoops. It's about a 20-page application. It's a series of surety bonds based not only on program enrollment, but a projection of the types of revenues you'll receive from the program, et cetera, et cetera. And then if you had the audacity to hire an online professor in another state, that required those two states to get some type of reciprocity organized. And that's just one student, one school, one example, one program. Well, in the world of state authorization, we have 54 states and territories, and we have approximately 4,000 institutions in the country. So if you can begin to imagine the complex web of authorizations and fees that are out there, it becomes a very unwieldy process very quickly. Plus, the laws always change, the fees always change, the students move, the instructors move, and institutions continually want to grow and expand their program offerings. So it is, the analogy I use to this process is like trying to put rubber bands around Jell-O. Every time you think you've got a handle on it, it squishes out the other side, and you can never be fully compliant. And now the U.S. Department of Education 3 years ago has come in and said, you know, if a school is not compliant with state-to-state authorization, we're going to try to tie that to your eligibility for Title IV funds, which is federal financial aid. Now, we've had a few years where the courts have intervened and said, we're not really sure you can do that, but we do now have a new set of proposed regulations coming out of the negotiated rulemaking process in Washington that's saying, well, I think we're going to do that anyway. We're going to go ahead and it looks like, it's not for certain yet, but there are going to be some pretty high stakes for not being in compliance. And the last time I talked to the expert on these things who's done the most research across the country in researching compliance in this matter is Russ Poulin out at WCET. And it still looks like fewer than 50% of colleges and universities across the nation are fully compliant or even approaching compliance on state authorization matters. This particular agreement cuts right through that. If you meet a certain set of criteria as an institution, if you as a state agree to uphold certain procedures and to hold those institutions accountable, the states agree to cooperate and accept the institutions that are signed up in one state to offer coursework in another state. It's a great opportunity for students, it's a great opportunity for institutions, and it's a great opportunity for U.S. higher ed. In particular, I see it as something that is beneficial to Minnesota because you have gold standard educational opportunities that people around the nation want to take advantage of, and if they are able to, they will. I see this as a net gain for the economy of Minnesota. And the other group that I find this particularly helpful, and I always like to remind people of, is the fact that our military students are greatly impacted by this. It really doesn't take much to make sure that you can't finish a program. If you are relocated, if you are deployed, and you happen to be in a program where they don't offer your course in another state and they're not authorized, then you have a problem. So there are a number of layers, and we can go into any. I could probably bore you ad infinitum on the scenarios here, but this kind of cuts right through it and gives us a nice middle ground where everyone can cooperate and compete on an even playing field for distance ed.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your work. So I have been attending conferences where this has been the subject of discussion, and so appreciate Ms. Park's expertise in this, and can tell you that I was on a call with the other commissioners from the Midwestern states, and I believe everyone is participating. It certainly
yes.
Gave their indication, you know, they would go back to their legislature, but had their intention to participate.
We have bills pending in every legislature in the Midwest with the exception of Michigan and Wisconsin, so 10 out of the 12 max states. And it looks like Pennsylvania will be coming on board and actually trying to join Sarah through the Midwestern Higher Education Compact as well. The reason we don't have a bill in Michigan is they just haven't been able to – they don't have an OHE, so they need to figure out a way to do this. And in Wisconsin, they have a similar situation. They just don't have one entity that could take the helm the way OHE can here.
Great. And the University of Minnesota has come before us and asked us to do this, as well as some of the not-for-profit privates have made the same request. So are there any questions about this? I believe, Mr. Fuller, there needed to be some small change in the language to make this work. Do you want us?
Sure. Madam Chair, on line page 3.2, delete everything after education up to the semicolon. Just a technical change. As long as we're talking about that, if you turn the page, we don't have to amend it because we're going to prepare another document. Right? Just notice to the members, or do you want to actually move it? Or I don't think you have to. We're just
no, that's right.
Then on page, what the witness was talking about, the flip side is you don't have to register is on page 4. Section 5, 4.16, and I noticed the same issue is there. So on line 4.18, the office may participate in interstate reciprocity agreements regarding post-secondary distance education, we would put after agreement, regarding post-secondary distance education. And then delete on 1.8 with similar, and on 1.9 agencies in other states. So it would read the office may participate in the interstate reciprocity agreement regarding post-secondary distance education if it determines. It sort of repeats, it exactly repeats your language. So. Anyway, that's the flip side of that one.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller.
And then if we go back on page 3, continuing where we left off, that's what Senator Claussen explained. Section 2 is Senate File 403. Section 3 is Senate File 403 with the proposed amendment. Section 4 is Senate File 403 with the proposed amendment. We just discussed Section 5. Section 6 is... is that the 2527, the Bonhoff proposal?
Yes, Mr.
Maybe Fuller. You want to talk about that.
Section 7 is just the top part of the bill we heard in committee with regard to the pilot project. Section 6.
Bottom of the page.
Right, Section 6, Subdivision 7.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, is the top part of the pipeline project bill where we gave the commissioner the ability to grant exemptions for minors participating in training programs. That was that part of that bill is now in here, and you'll see there are other places within the bill that the other pieces to that are captured.
Section 7 is the increase in the LME and the four-year tuition cap for the state grant program. You can see online 5.12, it's raised $620, the tuition cap in the second year of the biennium. And the LME is raised $400 in the second year, from $7,900 to $8,300. This is because there is a balance in the state grant program, and that's what was decided to do with it, or is proposed to do with it. Section 8, again, is Senator Bonhoff proposal, as is Section 9, as is Section 9. Yeah. You want to talk about those, Senator?
Mr. Fuller, again, this was taken from the pipeline project bill that we heard in here, creating the pilots, putting forward advisory councils to come up with competency standards in. When the bill was heard in our committee, we said advanced manufacturing, information technology, and healthcare services. And then based on the discussion here, and Senator Torres-Ray, you'll be pleased to see we added agriculture. So, so we are, and Senator Eakin, I know that that's important to you too, and Senator Sparks. So, and Senator Sparks did hear this bill as well.
And members on page 6, there are two reports. Titled report and reports. the first one is in the Senator Claussen 403, as he mentioned. The Office of Higher Education is to come back to the legislature next session prior to their ability to refinance loans to give the legislature a chance to understand what they're doing and whether or not they agree with it. And then Section 11 is a report that, again, was in the pipeline bill. It's requiring a report on the outcomes of what Section 8 is asking them to do and make further recommendations. That's it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fuller. And with regard to the appropriation section, I'll ask Ms. Weidman to take you through that, but I just wanted to preface it by saying that we were given a target that allowed us to do a few different things. So the raising the cap and the LME is not something we have to carry in our target because that money is within the closed state grant system and was something that the governor recommended in his proposal, and so we included that in our proposal. And I have talked to many members about that, and I believe there's a consensus about that. If there's not, please let me know. MNSCU, when we did our budget last session, if you'll recall, the Senate did not have a position whereby we froze the MNSCU tuition as we did the University of Minnesota tuition. That happened in conference, and so MNSCU came forward and said by making that change, they had a $17 million hole. We actually, Chair Plowski and I and the conferees worked very hard to come up with some money for to plug that hole. We did not plug it for the tails, and so really caused a problem for those doing that budget. And so what you'll see reflected in this fixes what I consider a tails problem. And so that's part of it. In addition, we did hear the bill regarding regenerative medicine. And to Senator Peterson's point, that is unusual in that we are supporting a University of Minnesota initiative, but we are doing so in such a way that it's an open process, so whereby we're giving research dollars to the university, outside entities can compete for that, whether it be Mayo Clinic or somebody else. So that's also why it's something that is out of the ordinary course with regard to the University of Minnesota. And then finally, in the governor's budget, the governor put forward an unusual appropriation for one system, which we don't do. You know, we don't pick and choose which system we're going to support with O&M dollars. The governor asked that we do an appropriation for Duluth in response to some specific problems. So given the target that we got, we were able to fulfill some of that. You'll see that we actually put forward within this a recommendation to support that request, and we've been in communication with University of Minnesota administration about that. So with that, if you could take us through the spreadsheet, Ms. Weidman.
Madam Chair, members, just for reference, I've included the governor's recommendations. I've included the governor's recommendations just as a reference point. And as Chair Bonoff indicated, there was $17 million put in for MNSCU in 15, and that carries forward into the tails. There was a one-time appropriation of $5 million for Duluth. So we have a total of an additional $22 million for 14-15, and then into the tails there's an additional $34 million. With the Senate proposal, we went along with the same appropriation amount or increase in appropriation amount for MNSCU, which is a base adjustment, and that moves forward into the tails. There was the one-time operating increase for Duluth. The Senate position was $3.5 million in comparison to the governor's $5 million. We also put in $5 million, which continues into the tails for the regenerative medicine. And then the final amount is the $250,000 for the apprenticeships. And as Senator Bonoff mentioned, there was money put in to increase the LME and the four-year tuition cap, which is consistent with the governor's recommendation. The most recent projection that was done of the state grant program needs showed a surplus of $20.5 million. And so that has been moved into making those changes. And members, there is a handout that was provided that shows you how both the LME and the tuition and fee cap, the impact of that across all sectors and income categories. So you may want to take a look at that to see how that plays out. Any questions?
It was our intention to share this with you today, give you some time to digest it, and then to take action on it on Thursday. There are a couple of things still floating around. One is Senator Cohn had a bill that would have put some a grant to support College Possible, which could be something that would come before higher ed or K-12, and that hasn't been quite sorted out. And so that could possibly be part of the discussion on Thursday. In addition, there's a study that I'm carrying to look. We spent a great deal of time talking about the workforce development funds, and so now there is a bill moving forward that would require and was heard in Senator Sparks' committee that would require DEED to do ROI analysis on those funds in a very detailed manner. That's something that I think if we're going to be accountable for those workforce funds, we ought to know exactly what's going on with that. And so that still hasn't been decided whether that would go through Tomasoni's or ours. So that would be the only other thing that you could see here on Thursday. So Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other item that's floating around is the credit transfer. And I know we sent it to the Senate floor, and I was hoping we were going to dual track it as well in the higher ed bill.
So good question. Senator Miller, I've had two conversations with my counterpart and hope that you might continue those conversations. We were told that in the bill that's moving forward, it had to be supplemental finance-related or provisions that have been agreed to. If they're policy, they really wanted to limit the policy. So I'm still working on it, and I hope you do too.
Madam Chair, I will continue to have those conversations.
Okay. Just even this morning, before I came here, I had my second conversation on it. So I really am working hard.
Me too.
So any other comments or questions? Yes, Senator Sparks.
One quick one, Madam Chair. And maybe she said this. On the underneath the University of Minnesota, the regenerative medicine, is that $5 million? Is that going forward? Is that ongoing money?
Madam Chair, Senator Sparks, yes, it is.
Okay.
Senator Sparks, when they came before us, they asked for $8 million the first year and $9 million the second. So that's how we did that.
Okay. No, thank you.
And members, if you look, there's many people here watching this conversation, so anybody could be called forward and ask questions. So don't be shy if you want to ask how somebody, you know, if you support something, how they'd use it. They're here because this is important to them. Thoughts about what you're looking at? Is there anyone who would like to come forward and testify, either for or in support or opposition? Yep, Ms. King, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And I just wanted to accept the invitation so that I could take this occasion to say thank you. I have several members of the board here, Trustee Dixon, Trustee Cirillo, and Trustee Erlinson, and we have some presidents here. They're all very, very hopeful that this support will present, and we're very grateful that it does.
Well, thank you, Ms. King. We're grateful that we were given the opportunity, that we were given a target that gave us the ability to do this. And as you know, it's something that we felt strongly about as well.
Thank
and
you
we're
so
sorry
much.
For what the tails problem caused you in the interim.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Ms. Grimes?
Madam Chair, for the record, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. I just wanted to speak briefly to the governor's recommendation on state grant program. You do have that spreadsheet that shows how it breaks out by sector and by income group. The recommendation is to increase the tuition maximums and the living and miscellaneous expense allowance to recalibrate the program to reflect real-world prices. It finishes the work begun last year to recalibrate the program and sets the stage for a focus on the trade-off between work and study as we consider the living and miscellaneous expense allowance in the future. It also sets the stage for future work on the amount middle-class families are expected to pay for college. It's an ongoing increase in the living and miscellaneous expense allowance of $400 from $7,900 now to $8,300 in fiscal year 15. This is a step toward a more realistic allowance for the non-tuition expenses of being enrolled, such as room and board, books, supplies, and transportation. It's also an ongoing increase in the tuition and fee maximum for four-year students in four-year programs, and it would increase the tuition and fee maximum from $13,000 to $13,620. This allows the state grant program to have a tuition maximum that is equal to the most expensive public four-year institution. These changes can be accommodated using the projected balance in the state grant appropriation with no additional appropriation. And it's because of enrollment decline has created some room in the projected spending. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
I think we're good, Ms. Grimes. And it is noted that we would serve 311 more students and that we would, on average, increase the state grant $54.
Madam Chair, actually, compared to the base year, it would be 4,391 students. The 311 students
thank
is
you.
Compared.
That didn't make
if
sense.
If you just look at what would have happened if we'd have increased LME $400, and then if you take the next step and do the governor's recommendation.
Thank you. Got it.
Okay.
Good. All right. Any other questions? Anybody else like to testify? Mr. Stanton, nice to see you here.
Yes.
We don't want you to retire.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, I have to run to a meeting in the House, I did want to thank you for taking care of the $17 million tails problem. As you know, it's been plaguing us, and I did want the record to show that Vice Chancellor King and I did agree on this. So,
let the record reflect agreement. Thank you. Right. University, would you like to?
Madam Chair, Senators, on behalf of the University of Minnesota and the Board of Regents and the President, you've got another great bill
this year,
and we're fully in support of it, and we appreciate the additional appropriations and the help you're giving students.
Well, thank you, Pitts. It's great to have you here. We appreciate it. Okay. Mr. Sirkvenik.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Paul Sirkvenik, President of the Minnesota Private College Council, and I too want to add my word of thanks to the committee and you, Madam Chair, for the great bill you put together, and in particular, we're very grateful for the continuing improvements in the Minnesota State Grant Program. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, you know, this is just step one. First of all, we haven't voted on it, so hopefully we'll have strong bipartisan support because that makes a difference. And then there will be a negotiation with the House because they didn't get the same great target that we did. So we'll see how that goes.